From a light rail station in the middle of Main Street, it's Main Street Mesa. Welcome to Main Street Mesa, where we discuss issues around building a more human, people-centered community in Mesa and other communities like that.
I'm Ryan Wozniak.
And I'm David Crummy, and we are here to catch you up on what we've been doing for the last, how long?
Four or five months, I don't know.
It's been 2 weeks.
We've been off the hook, and we're sorry about that, but we're back with a vengeance.
Not sorry at all.
Well, here's the thing. We've been busy in ways that make our Series 2 that much more impressive.
Don't lie to the people. Don't lie to the people.
It's gonna be good.
But we finally picked the book for the next podcast series, Happy City by Charles Montgomery. One of the main reasons that we picked this is, one, that it was recommended by our bicycle transportation planner, Jim Hash, when he joined us for our bike episode, way back in episode 8, man.
Way back.
We also had Charles Montgomery came to town at the invitation of LISC and MAG, which is the Maricopa Association of Governments. LISC is the Local Initiative Support Corporation, Phoenix office. They sponsored the event. He drove around with some MAG representatives and LISC representatives, and they checked stuff out. And then they sort of reflected on the valley, and I missed that. I had somewhere else to be that evening.
Yeah, it was nice that he just didn't speak to the things that he knew and hey, here's my book and here's why it's great. No, he actually sort of tried to apply some of this wisdom that he's collected from all of these stories that are in the book and say, well, how does that kind of match what I'm seeing in Phoenix? So I think that it was really an approachable talk that he gave.
We also heard that MAG is going to be using this book, or at least the inspiration from the book, as they're working on their active transportation plan, ATP.
Yeah, seen that as part of MAG's active transportation committee member for the city of Maricopa. I kind of get to touch that hands-on. So I'm looking forward to that. I think that that's a good group. Everybody has a good head on their shoulders in that committee. They're passionate people who want to do a good job.
Maricopa County is large. It is roughly the same size as the state of Israel, if you want to think about that. And so think about that as a planning boundary, planning area. We have rural areas, we have semi-rural areas, urban and densely urban, and 23 miles of light rail.
Does that make Mexico our Palestine?
No, it makes makes Pinal County
our immediate boundary.
We had some border skirmishes. This is good. We're going to stop there with the...
not going to go off the rails.
All right, we're done. We're bigger than Vermont? I don't know if that's true. Someone Google that. Get back to us.
Rhode Island, probably.
Probably. But it is a complex issue, and it is one of those things that we really need to understand better. If we look at it economically, we haven't had an increase in net earnings in average income in more than 40 years. We're about flat since the 70s. And our costs for other things are going up. Housing costs are going up, transportation costs are going up, and we need to build more people-friendly cities so we're not having to pay out the wazoo for our transportation costs when all of our other costs are going. And that's one of the places where cities that were built before the 1950s, before the advent of massive government spending to increase the sizes of roads, and the advent of poor planning, honestly, or planning
misguided.
For... Misguided. Planning, or it's actually great planning if you want to drive places.
Yeah.
Not great planning if you want to drive places quickly, because we created a lot of congestion through that. And we're not good at moving people, but we are better at moving cars. Mm. And we need to switch around that thought process and start thinking about how are we going to better move people. Cars are always going to be a component of that, but moving people should be our goal, not moving cars.
Yeah, and there are many technical reasons for that. And part of this discovery process and thinking about these and asking these questions is not to say that all the answers are easy. as to how we get from here to there to a more people-oriented transportation modes. But we have to at least acknowledge that we haven't got it right. And if we haven't got it right, why do we continue to use the same tools and the same metrics and the same policy process and continue to make the same mistakes? And so something that Gil Peñalosa said recently can be conveyed to folks. And that's, we are not spectators. We have to be participants in this process of bettering our cities and making them work for us and saying what doesn't work for us and demanding better. I think that's important.
It is. So you've already started reading the book. I haven't opened it up yet.
Okay.
I bought a couple copies. I passed them along to a few people. One of them has already finished the book.
Excellent.
In the time. They loved it. So hopefully we'll have them on at a later episode. Ryan, what's striking you so far as you're reading this book as to why we should be talking about it?
So I think that the brilliant ways that both this book and the previous book, Walkable City by Jeff Speck, it gives you all these lenses to look at the importance of how we organize our city in different ways. And it depends on what you want to nerd out about. If you want to nerd out about what makes your city most economically prosperous, there's some takeaways for you. If you want to talk about what makes your opportunities to be a healthier person living in your community, there's a takeaway for you. So I think that in the same vein that Walkable Cities did that for us in our first series, Happy City is going to do that for us in this coming series. Thing. And then there's going to be examples that he has that that talk about not just why, but then how it's been done. So to prove that it's feasible. And if you're hearing heavy breathing in the background, that is my dog.
That is Soder having fun, enjoying being on the couch.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a number of items that have been going on in the news recently.
Yes.
Most exciting for me has been just this weekend, just yesterday, we had the first residents moving into Art Space Mesa.
Very cool.
Which, really excited about that. Every time I visited that site over the last 8-9 months since it was a dirt lot to right now, it is gorgeous. And we're not done yet. It won't be done until this summer. But the first building is, the residences are done.
For people who aren't familiar with the site, can you tell them where they can take a peek at ArtSpace?
Yes. If you are older than 40 years old and you grew up in Mesa, just go to where Temple Court used to be. That was a community that was torn down in the 80s and 90s as part of blight remediation. But it was sort of a low-income community. A lot of little homes right on Hibbert, just south of First Street. Half a block away from Republica Empanada.
Mm. These people are going to have great access to good food.
Yeah. you need to eat at Republica Empanada and afterwards take a stroll through the Mesa Urban Garden. And as a requirement for listening to this podcast, is go and eat some French fries and some empanadas and a good salad, a margarita.
And then enjoy the beautiful art and plantings at Mesa Urban Garden. A really cool community. Definitely an expression of community love that has manifested itself into both art and fresh vegetables.
And which is exactly why the Art Space project is just around there. And so that is artist housing, 50 homes for families. So 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms. And it's just exciting. There were tears yesterday. It was beautiful. What do you have as an update?
Well, there's certainly a lot of interesting things that are happening downtown that I thought would just be important to remind folks of just what's in the queue, right? So ASU prospects aren't going away. They've downsized their potential of startup, but I think this speaks to one of the takeaways of one of the groups that I know that me and Crummy enjoy, which is Strong Towns, and one of their biggest missions is to emphasize the importance of incrementalism. And so maybe I think that this revisited idea of ASU coming to downtown in a smaller footprint is a way to kind of borrow from the benefits of incrementalism. Now, I know it's a bit of a mixed bag. It's not exactly the perfect situation. ASU has deep pockets, and why can't they just make this work on their own? Why does it necessarily need to be a slush fund of enterprise funds coming from the city side? But all in all, I see this as a positive adventure for the prospects of downtown Mesa as being one of these energizers that extend the hours of operation for downtown Mesa, which is one of the biggest things that I think that keep it from having the nightlife and the extended hours that people come to expect from a downtown environment. So that's kind of one of the biggest things that excites me. And then on top of that, you have some of the promises that have come out of the Brookings Institute with innovation districts and trying to get the right blend of things happening there.
We stay talking a little bit about the ASU downtown proposal.
Okay.
So it is a yet-to-be-determined project. They're looking at one building, and if it's successful, doing a second building. Budget to be determined.
Mm-hmm.
City and ASU have signed a memorandum of understanding, a letter basically saying that they're going to hash this all out. I believe that comes back in the next month or so.
Yeah. The benefits of an MOU being that, hey, we all agree that this is a decent framework, and now let's start working out the details. Right. So I think some of the MOU details being that the city would dedicate land and a site that the city owns, that the city would design a shell of a building, and then ASU gets to be responsible for the guts and the technical aspects of how the internal of the building would work. I know that there's elements about the first floor being retail and how the ASU would be managing the O&M costs. What's that? Operations and maintenance. And
I think that one of the things we need to do, and I think we're both bad about it on the podcast, or in life in general, we need to. Scott Smith, when he was mayor of Mesa, instituted a swear jar for acronyms. Yeah. Acronyms and jargon.
So basically, ASU is responsible for making sure that these retail spaces are managed on the first floor, and the basic idea, and I think there's some details to be worked out here, is that they pass on a check that whatever revenues come out of that that space get passed on to the city. So the city starts to see some payback on this initial investment early on. And I think that's a good idea.
They'll never reconstitute the entire initial investment of the construction of the building. And so this is really the question is this an excellent way that the city can basically build this as infrastructure?
Mm-hmm.
Like we build sewers. We just spent $350 million building a new sewer treatment plant out in East Mesa with these bond dollars. And we'll never see the money back from that. That's something that we don't pay for except for on debt service. Same thing with the Cubs stadiums and the other stadiums, other places that we think that could be an economic driver or is otherwise necessary that gets paid for not as a profit-oriented but a investment-oriented
mm-hmm.
project that it builds a better community. Personally, I'm still on the fence on this. It's an interesting idea. There's no guarantee of success. We know that communities that have large footprints from universities have great successful downtowns. What do they call it? Towns and gowns is mm-hmm. the jargony thing. We've seen huge changes in downtown Phoenix, an activation because of the passing of a bond issue in Phoenix, where Phoenix voters passed a bond. It was a lot, $300-400 million to build ASU buildings. And it's really had a huge stimulus in the downtown. And that's a lot of students. That's more than 10,000 students. We're looking at something smaller, starting mm-hmm. with, I think, is it 300, 400, 500, somewhere in that range?
I don't recall.
So basically, it will in the first couple of years, it will end up being about the same size as Benedictine University, which is already mm-hmm. downtown.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see how this works out and how it shakes out, how the programs that end up being there, the students that hang out there, do they stay there? One of the components that's not part of the MOU, that's not, or that's part of the MOU but not part of the city commitment, is that ASU will build student housing in downtown at their own expense. And housing is important. Housing is probably the biggest priority we have in downtown Mesa, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think we discovered that as we talked, or we delved into that last series when Jeff Specs talked about bringing housing back to downtowns and how downtowns had pushed out housing for so long and oriented themselves around business and office uses and how
parking.
Lots of parking.
I went back and I looked at the historic aerials of downtown and we, right around the time where we started adding buildings to downtown, you know, we've only been more 120 years old, more or less. And you can go back to about 1920 on the historic aerials. You can look at the images and you're like, oh, look, there's more buildings, there's more buildings, there's more buildings. Oh, they've started tearing down buildings, and the hollowing out of downtown started. We lost a lot of floor space on our ground floor in the 60s and 70s. I knew that was true of other communities, but I went and I looked at the historic aerials and there it is.
Yeah, and one of the conversation pieces that came out of the ASU MOU talks is the mayor said that downtown Mesa is one of these places that aspires to have a parking problem. But then, lo and behold, they start diving into, well, will this cause a parking problem? So, like, while they understand that they want to have enough people and enough energy to have a parking problem, they still worry about the parking. And that can be the barrier to ever growing enough energy to have the parking problem in the first place. And it's kind of a silly issue. With everything, the crystal ball that we can think about when it comes to parking demands, we're seeing that there's a lot of reasons to think that parking demand is going to be on the decline for the foreseeable future, with the more, with people using Uber more. And this kind of is a good segue
to going back to our active transportation plan. Mm-hmm. People not using cars.
Yeah.
One of the big problems with cars, especially in downtowns, is that we are massively subsidizing the storage of personal property. One of my favorite quotes, and I don't remember if it's Gil or Enrique Peñalosa, but says, it's like, the government doesn't have to find a way to store your underwear. Why are we trying to find a way that, why do you think that you have to look to the government to store the rest of your personal property, i.e. your car?
And not just the government, right? It's the government imposing that on every private property owner who owns a business who needs to have clientele that comes to their business. And lo and behold, it is just assumed that the vehicle needs to be accommodated in this trip. And by assuming that it needs to be accommodated, what we're doing is inducing that that effect, right? So we've talked about that.
And creating.
We've talked about that before. So yeah. I don't think we need to delve into that too much.
No.
But it is a good reminder.
Why don't you, and so part and, not part and parcel, somewhat separate, but not completely removed, is the idea of Cahoots Mesa.
Yeah. So, and this also complements that ASU downtown, or that ASU MOU that we're talking about, right? So by having a lot of young, energetic, entrepreneurial minds in and around downtown, think about that in conjunction with the potential for having this Cahoots co-working space, where you have, you're bringing in the opportunities to grow a business in a downtown, and in an interesting way where you're being challenged by other entrepreneurs to think your concepts through more vividly. You're able to think your concepts through very thoroughly, and you work with other entrepreneurs, people that come at this from different angles. And so you get a more comprehensive understanding of what it takes to make your young business successful. And so having this incubation space, having this co-working space, flexibility and creativity being baked into the whole environment and process of who you're running into and this intermingling, all that is the kind of the magic that can happen when you bring enough people with the time and the energy to invest in a place like Cahoots.
Yeah, well, and I don't think that it's actually much related to ASU. The students that will be there, the programs they've proposed, I don't think would interact much with an organization like Cahoots, because Cahoots is more about entrepreneurs that need office space and need flexibility in office space and that are willing to pay for that opportunity. But they also, Cahoots brings a lot of, and you can go visit them in downtown Phoenix, but they offer a lot of programming for their members and also for the public. And that's exciting. And we're excited to see the Cahoots Foundation working as well and see where they can come with that. And that Cahoots will be part of a new development called The Grid, mm-hmm. unrelated to The Grid Bike Share or The Grid Growlers and Games. A barcade.
That's too many grids.
Down the street. Many grids. So that project expected to move forward, start doing some applications for their program, for their process in the next 6-8 months. Start construction some period after that. So we're excited to see what that looks like.
And I think that where I get excited about ASU's collaboration in conjunction with Cahoots, though, is that young people have a lot of great ideas coming out of college, and they have this opportunity to make their internship phase of their life a great experiment. And once you kind of grow up and gain a mortgage and a house and you all these liabilities, there's a lot more risk involved in taking a risk towards your entrepreneurial future. So I feel like there's fewer barriers for young people coming out of college to really take advantage of Cahoots.
And that's one of the big problems that we have here in the Valley, is that young people coming out of college don't stay.
Yeah.
They leave. There was recently a report out that talked about that. We had at the Mesa Urban Development Summit, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we had, I believe it was Scott Polakoff from Gateway Planning, the Congress of New Urbanism, talked about, you know, we have a Ferrari of a code, we have a beautiful community, and we have all of these students, at this time it was Benedictine University in Wilkes and Westminster University. Mm-hmm. We have all these students coming here, test driving our downtown, test driving our community. What are we going to do to make them stay? Because the university doesn't keep people here. It allows people to come and test drive. It stimulates the economy in that way. But how do you keep people here? John Talton, roguecolumnist.com, maybe, recently wrote an article about young, educated, progressive thinking people should stay away from the Valley because we eat them alive. It kills me because I say Portland is for quitters. This is the community where we want to work. And he basically said, yeah, but you're going to get destroyed. There's little you can do. And that was rather depressing. I believe I sent it to you as a message that said, oh, God.
Oh, God, yes. The recent column, title of the article was, Do I Return to My Home State?
It's a great article, a little depressing. But that's why something like Cahoots is a much more important component, I think. But it requires a lot more things to be successful. ASU can, you know, they created ASU all the way, Polytechnic, all the way out in the middle of nowhere, out in the desert. And that's fairly successful because they can sort of be their own driver. A place like Cahoots needs the entrepreneurial spirit, the people that are looking for space that meets their needs, that are at that point where they can move out of their house and start paying some rent, either daily or monthly, to get some desk space in a collaborative, communicative area. And that's great, but it's only a component. I think we're always looking for a golden bullet.
Silver, or golden, whatever.
Depleted uranium, yeah. Whatever. whatever it is valuable. That we're looking for to solve our problems. And there is no one solution. We need to be reminded of that.
And I think that this book and Walkable Cities was also a great reminder of that. And so I hope that comes across as we explore this in our second series.
So next up, Dockless Bikes.
Dockless bikes, the good, bad, and the ugly of what this new modality of choice
what
that we have.
What the heck is modality?
Modality.
That's a quarter.
That's a quarter. I was going to explain it. We want different modes of transportation, right? That's modality.
What does that mean?
Modes, options.
Options.
What are you gonna choose? What mode of transportation are you gonna choose to get from A to B? And it doesn't necessarily need to be one. This is
two.
This is the magic.
Because even if you drive, You walk to get to the car.
Yes.
And you walk from the car to wherever you're going. So two modes of transportation.
Two modes of transportation at minimum, unless there's some...
Unless you're just walking.
Unless you've found a dimension of the universe that does the WALL-E thing, where everybody just floats around. And
we call that walking enhanced. Enhanced walking.
Enhanced walking. And, you know, like, if we're not careful with where technology takes us, that's exactly the warning of WALL-E, which I love that movie for that warning.
Self-walking.
Yeah. So when we think about different transportation options, it's not choose one option and then be done with it. It's how do all these things kind of come together? And so while these things are crappy clutter along our sidewalks and our streets, in a way, it's
almost dockless bikes.
Dockless bikes, that being
bicycles you can borrow,
rent for $1 an hour, which is a very much a steal. They're also stealing your data. They want to figure out how you get to and from places so that they can sell that information, just like Google. Like, all this free stuff that we get from Google isn't necessarily free, right? They're tracking the ideas that we have, the ways that we use. Or
Facebook, more famously at the moment. Well, what do they say? If any product you use is free, you are actually the product. The
product, yes. And so that's exactly the case with these $1 an hour dockless bike rentals. And so, like, they're not as clean as the grid bikes that we've become accustomed to, because we know where those need to start and where those need to end, and so they get, like, lined up nice and pretty. These yellow and limey green and yellow things that you've seen, there's the Lime Bike, there's the Ofo. These companies have made their way into our market in the last 5 months or so, and it's really changed the face of how pretty and how cluttered it is.
It's interesting, and you can go to the Instagram Litter Bikes of AZ to see pictures of people trashing these bikes, putting them in trees, bottoms of canals, rivers. They create visual clutter. I was trying to understand why I had a problem with them. I thought it was because of the visual clutter, and it was. And I also didn't see a lot of people using them. But now that I've been paying more attention, there are tons of people using them.
They are. I see them all the time. So one of the best routes that me and my wife like to do is the new shared path that runs along the Rio Salado waterway, leads to Tempe Town Lake. The portion here turns into our protected bike, a cycle track that runs north-south along Alma School for a short bit, is the Stadium Connector, as it's branded. I see people using these bike rentals quite frequently, and just a quick count to Tempe Town Lake and back one morning a couple weekends ago, I would say approximate half the users on this shared use path was using these dockless bikes.
And I'm now in my new home on a city bike path and just been watching the people riding their bikes up and down the street. And fairly frequently, I'm seeing people riding these, not just individuals, but I've seen entire families on them. I've seen all class of people riding them. It's really inspiring, and that sort of made them a lot more okay in my head. We still have to figure out how to deal with the clutter, but I keep laughing at, I think it's Strong Towns keeps posting pictures of dockless cars cluttering our streets.
That was actually a beautiful article by Slate that the Strong Towns has been pushing. So if you've been paying attention to the conversation at all, you've seen that there's, like, all these huge piles of abandoned bikes that have been collected and basically create their own landfills in China because there was such an overinvestment in this technology of dockless bikes. So what they've end up having to do is the governments have gone and try to clear up a lot of the clutter, and what that's created is mountains and mountains of these bikes, and it's just astonishing to look at in the pictures. And while there's a critical eye to be had there, don't forget about the alternative that we've been dealing with forever, the dockless car and the sea of parking, right? Like, this is also visual clutter. This is also an impediment to our dreams and what we want out of our cities.
We've converted huge swaths, huge tracts of land
yes.
to store dockless cars.
Yeah. As long as they're like lined up in pretty rows that are approximately 9 feet apart from each other. Like maybe we
nine
just
feet give ancient, a, 8 inches.
The standard that I could tell that maybe you have a little bit of heartburn with, David.
Oh, it's all heartburn. It's bigger than most people's bedrooms.
So yeah, the incredible amount of space that's allocated towards cars and has been for decades. Let's not forget about that alternative when we look at the prospects of the dockless bike helping reduce that waste of space. And so while there is problems with dockless bikes that I don't want to overlook, the visual clutter, the prospects of it getting in the way of a disabled person, either tripping over them because that disabled person is blind, not expecting that thing, scattered bikes all over the place, or it be somebody in a wheelchair that has a hard time getting to a ramp because the bike has been thrown in the way. Like, there needs to be a cultural mind shift about how do we use these dockless bikes responsibly. And I think if they can be done responsibly, I think that they're a great add-on to the options of getting from A to B that we have in the city, because you can jump on one and leave it in a convenient place for you to jump on it again and again and again.
Next up is recently we had the tragedy of the death of one of our community members here in Tempe, right next to Mesa, Elaine Herzberg, who was made national headlines as being the first recorded death due to automated vehicles, autonomous vehicles. Or
it depends on that, whose side of the debate you take on this language.
But it was a Uber vehicle that was being mm-hmm. tested. They were all over the place, driving around in packs across Tempe and Mesa. And apparently their technology is just not up to snuff.
And it's been interesting how the U.S. Department of Transportation has gotten themselves involved in the investigation as to who's to blame in this situation. It's really created quite the stir in the planning and transportation worlds, right? Like who's to blame? What are we looking at this holistically enough? Is it really fair to blame technology that has such promise to save lives? Let's not lose, the forest for the tree. All these arguments about, like, you can tell that there's all this emotional investment in the promise of the AV technology.
Well, and the thing that gets me the most, I think, out of this is the reporting. Tempe police coming out and saying that the woman darted out from a dark corner across the street and there's no way to evade it. And then Uber released a really terribly shot video, which is either a very poor camera or was doctored to become darker, decreasing the contrast in it. Looking at that, knowing that street, Mill Avenue, that section of the road, she was crossing at a point where it was more than 1,000 feet from a crosswalk, which mm-hmm. we already know that people won't walk that far, so you have to make that happen. It was actually a place where it visually looks like there's a crosswalk, or there's sidewalks in either end, but there's a small sign that says don't cross. Which we know people don't follow. It was a clear night. It was well lit. And, this is a Volvo XC90. This is a real fancy SUV with great headlights. And the speed limit was either 35 or 45.
I think it's 40 miles per hour through that stretch.
I think it was 35, but the next speed limit sign was 40 or 45.
Okay.
And the vehicle was accelerating to that. But by law, you can't go faster until you past the limit.
Right.
But, we don't know the exact details. But she was walking her bike across the street with some groceries. She was a homeless woman.
Yeah, which adds to the social dynamics of what a person's worth. And that's really kind of crappy when you start seeing people kind of lean towards discounting who she is because of her homeless factor. And so I just want to
Is the week after we had 10 deaths in Phoenix from people crossing the street, and every single report is, oh, they were not in a crosswalk. It starts with they're not in the crosswalk. Mm-hmm. It starts with
victim blaming.
Victim blaming, or however you want to put that. The idea that this is not, it's fine. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't have been walking.
Yeah. How much responsibility should be put on them versus the driver versus this. I don't know how, what do you think these machines go for with all the Uber sensor equipment and everything?
That oh, I'm sure it's easily hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, we're probably talking close to $1 million worth of a machine here that's been equipped to deal with the safety of these situations. And due to some decision to kind of pull back on the number of sensors, it may have been the decision that led to this unfortunate event.
Well, and we know, or at least I am fairly comfortable saying that if a human was driving that, if the safety driver was paying attention, Elaine Herzberg would be alive today. They just would have tapped on the brakes and it would have been fine. Through the errors in the system, through the safety driver not paying attention, it led to the death of a human being on our streets. And so, which is all too common.
And here's the interesting dimension. People will like to pick apart, like, well, is it fair to be so critical of this corporation who's in it to, you know, yes, make a profit, but their ultimate takeaway is that they will have this technology that they bring to the markets to save lives. Is it so bad to criticize them over this one? Oops, it's just the cost of doing business. It's just the cost of progress. So I have a hard time grappling with that concept a little bit. I understand the message, but let's not forget about that when a corporation does something, it is very calculated. Whereas if a driver behind a wheel makes a mistake, it was far less calculated. It was truly an accident in the real terms of what accident means. When an Uber machine has an accident, it's not as accidental as we give a little bit of oops factor to an individual person. So I think that's a critical part of the conversation to grapple with.
Yeah. Well, and I think that part of what we have to grapple with is that this was the most deadly year on record for automobiles, people driving, being killed. Was it 45,000 people this year? You remember?
37?
Almost 40,000 people a year are killed on our roads in the United States due to cars. A portion of those are people killed crossing a street, on sidewalks, and we need to understand, we all need to be better drivers. We all need to be more alert at the wheel because it is our responsibility driving a 3,000-pound, I don't know, depending on your car, 80 to 280 horsepower vehicle that uses gasoline and is incredibly powerful, technologically advanced piece of equipment, to be more aware of the squishy human beings that we do not want to interact with our giant boats. All of this talk and all of this thinking has really made me a better driver. I'm trying to pay a lot more attention, do all the things I learned in driving school, scanning the horizon. But we have a question that I'm really worried about is that deaths due to vehicles are very rarely prosecuted. It is probably the easiest way to kill someone and get away with it.
And also, who are all the actors to blame in a scenario, right? So if you follow Strong Towns at all, they'll be very critical as to, well, maybe the DOT, the city, the folks that are making the decision as to the standards for where crosswalks go, what speeds cars should travel, they're not really making the wisest decisions in or prioritizing the other folks' safety who use the street. And it comes down to a kind of a cultural and an expectation as to who owns the street, who does the street serve. And I think that there's many different types of streets and roads and strodes that
what's a strode?
Look it up on Strong Towns. It's the best combination. It's the poorest combination of trying to get a lot of traffic and a lot of people all on the same.
Basically, a road designed to kill people.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. Is in our reporting of these tragedies, of these deaths of real human beings, we don't talk about road design. We typically the first line At least a few times, I've seen the very first line, a pedestrian crossing outside of the sidewalk was killed.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't put any of the conversation or blame or attribute to, we put sidewalks next to 45-mile-an-hour roads where people will die if they're struck by a vehicle. If that vehicle strays off the road, and people do that all the time, if people are on their cell phones, if someone is just looking down and they just step out. We've designed our roads to be places where it's unsafe to be a child or a pet, even on our little residential streets, because they encourage speeding. And we need to, our news media needs to hold to account more than just the person crossing the street.
Yeah, and if they're not going to do it, then we need letters to the editor to remind them to do it. Join us in
that. That was depressing.
Yeah, that was a very unhappy start to our Happy City book.
Well, but the reason we need Happy City is because we don't have one.
Yeah, the alternative is very unhappy.
We have a few personal updates. Ryan suckered me into going to Savannah, Georgia.
Oh, you poor guy, you.
A community I've always wanted to visit. Beautiful part of the country. And we'll be attending the Congress of the New Urbanism, numero 26.
That's 26 for you English speakers.
Colonizers.
This is going to happen kind of middle to late May, May 16th through the 19th. We'll be excited to be going and doing this. It's great to do this with David. It'll be my first conference and this CNU, Congress of New Urbanism platform. There's a lot of great leadership found at the CNU, Jeff Speck being one of them, Andres Duane, and if you follow any of these kind of books, you'll...
Duane Plater-Zyberg, DPZ.
Yeah, yeah,
so. Galina Tachieva will be there. All these sort of like people, I don't know, rock stars in building livable communities. I am really enamored with the Congress for the New Urbanism, with the CNU. And just their way of saying, we need to fix the way we build things and stop doing it the old way.
And you're not the only one enamored with it. Like, if in the world of like planning and building for new cities, there's a couple big conferences that come to my mind. The American Planning Association puts on one. The ULI, the
Urban Land Institute,
puts on a big one. So there's a couple of these big kind of conglomerations of people who have joined in and bought into a message and become members of these organizations that create these pretty big events. But I would say that of all the ones that I know of, there's a more religious fundamentalist following to the CNU crowd that is second to none. And I kind of enjoy the amount of like of excitement and community that
builds. It's much more passionate than the Planning Association. Although I did go to the Planning Association conference in Vegas, 10 years ago or so. That was a heck of a party, but not super passionate. did get to go to the Congress for the New Urbanism in Buffalo, and that was a heck of a party and incredibly passionate. I don't necessarily believe in they get pretty strong opinions, and I'm more of a, all right, how do we apply this tomorrow? But I'm just excited to go and sort of get my feet wet again and drinking the Kool-Aid over there.
Yeah.
And visiting Savannah, which is
beautiful.
Beautiful
coastal city that has this really historic layout. And I love how it kind of disperses a little bit of magic throughout its downtown in a way that I think is pretty cool and unique.
Have you been before?
No, but just so getting excited about it, I've spent a fair amount of time on Google Street View and kind of got it just a vaguely familiar lay of the land. And so I'm really looking forward to experiencing it firsthand.
I'm just looking for good food. That's my first interest.
I like how I've gotten you to come around on the bike rental option
I thought we could walk. Uh-huh. But between where we're staying and where the event is, I think it's too far. I think the bike is the way to go. I would have preferred to walk, but I think it's just way more convenient to be on a bike, especially when I'm looking at places where I want to go. I'm going to need a bike.
Well, I would think that the historic footprint of Savannah is large enough to be best appreciated with a little bit faster of modality.
Yes. And stab me. And the other point is that I'm trying to do a little bit of look at the history, because you know the history of the United States and before, and the European colonizers and the slave trade and everything that's happened over the past 400, 500, 600 years is so fascinating, and it really comes alive in a community that sort of has a piece of everything. You know, Savannah was integral in the Civil War, in the slave trade. You know, that was a part of indigenous America that was incredibly well populated up until people died horribly.
Viruses.
Bullets, knives, all of the above. And it's fascinating. And I don't know, part of it is I'm trying to get a better understanding of our place in the United States today, based on the history, how we came together, and visiting a place like that. I like, never mind that I like small streets and massing of the buildings, and you know, I'll be nerding out about that too.
So this is all the good stuff that we'll try to bring a piece of that back to you guys via the podcast, and the intersection with a lot of other cool people. We'll definitely be doing our best to record some
There's
of
no
that.
one cooler than us.
Well, there's people who try, and we'll try to get those cool people onto our podcast.
By the way, final wrap-up item. Ryan,
Okay.
you had an interesting Twitter interaction the last week,
Yeah, let
2 weeks ago.
So they say that, you know, like what you do with your career isn't about what you know, it's about who you know. And I'm going to modify that to it's not about what you know, it's about who you tweet at.
Who you pester on Twitter.
It's only right because Twitter has now become the White House's go-to information dispersal center, right? Where we get formal communications from the President of the United States. Why not? It'd be a great place to interact with Jeff Speck. And so, in the news of having to celebrate that we're going to CNU's conference together in Savannah, I tweeted at the Congress of New Urbanism that,
And Jeff Speck.
well, no, I did not tag him. He's just a leader in
Oh, yeah,
CNU. He's
you're
just a
right.
leader in it, so he follows it. And so his involvement was out of left field. But I tweeted that who else is interested in this traditional urbanist voodoo? And then so lo and behold, I get a response from Jeff Speck, and that says that he misread my tweet as, I thought you said, who's getting a traditional urbanist tattoo? And then back and forth, an entertaining exchange happens where I say that I would get a t an urbanist tattoo with the 10 steps of walkability tattooed on my arm if Mr. Jeff Speck himself paid for it. And so he found that an intriguing proposition, but he had like ethical qualms with it,
Walking
and
billboard, Ryan.
It was just very interesting, entertaining exchange that ended with the idea that, well, in ex rather than you doing this tattoo that I pay for, how about you come and be part of a class that I teach at Harvard, titled Me as an Intern, and that Harvard would then pay the cost of the tuition and Jeff Speck pay the cost of my airfare. I do not
Which is
know. I
amazing.
do not know how lucky of somebody I am. To get such a off the wall offer out of Twitter, just by having an entertaining exchange with somebody. But I'm taking it. I'm running with it. I'm gonna see what I can do with this opportunity. It is an executive level course titled The Walkable City, and it's going to span June 28th and 29th. And I'm going to be trying to dig into all of the good ideas that we heard from the folks that we had on this podcast. The exchanges and the deep questions that me and David had about how the walkable city is applied to the city of Mesa. I'm going to do the best I can to make the most of this opportunity and dig into all the walkable city nerdiness that I can. And I actually wouldn't mind extending the fun by inventing, get this, inventing a game called Walkable City, where we gamify a downtown Mesa street, and talk about all the different design criteria and coming up with some sort of point and payment system out of the ideas that are found in the book. And so it would be kind of a fun, maybe come have a few drinks and play this game that I've created. So I invite anybody who's listening to this, I will be sharing iterations as I try to piece together an entertaining game out of the concept of Walkable
Oh, that is lovely.
City.
That is all we have for today.
Yes.
Join us online on Facebook and Tumblr at, well, don't go to Tumblr. We don't
No, we
use
don't
that
do it.
anymore.
No.
Facebook at Main Street Mesa. You are activating our Twitter account, Main
Yep.
Street Mesa. Email your comments to mainstmesa@gmail.com. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts. Rate us on iTunes, 5 stars to help us get the word out.
Join us next episode. We hope to have on a very fun guest, and we will be doing more than just talking about the section, the first beginning section of Happy City, but we will also be having on a special guest who's also a podcast host herself, Sarah Copper, who does a podcast about either having a car-free or car-light lifestyle. And she interviews people all across the country about what it takes to make that work in within their own city. And so she'll be joining us from Bloomington, Indiana. And Bloomington, Indiana is a very interesting location. And we'll talk about how that compares to Mesa in our upcoming episode.
And then right after that, we'll be starting our podcast book club with Happy City by Charles Montgomery. You can follow Ryan on Twitter at RyanWoesPHX.
You guys should follow David on Twitter at DavidCrummy. That's CRUMMEY. David, there's no surprises with the spelling of
What?
that.
Our theme music is written by Philip Buckman, performed by the Sweaty Palm Trees, and produced and recorded by David Wiersch. I'm David Crummy.
I'm Ryan Wozniak.
Easy travels.
Bye.